Have you been hitting the books and listening to lectures all day? It's time to relax, to unwind, and listen up. This is Brooke from Campus Chronicles, your go-to podcast for everything student life. No matter where you are in your academic journey, we have you covered. Think of us as a trusted mentor, friend, and confidant who always has your back. We'll be sharing inspiring stories, thought-provoking insights, and practical advice to help you succeed in and out of the classroom. So get ready to be inspired, enlightened, and entertained. Hello, hello, everyone. I am so incredibly excited about the episode that we have prepared today. I'm here with Pete Quinn of Pete Quinn Consulting. Pete, thank you for being here.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
I think we're going to have an exciting conversation. But first, before we dive into all that nitty-gritty detail, share your origin story with us. And I know that that can be a hard question. How did you get into this line of work?
Okay, so I was fortunate enough a long time ago to work at University of Oxford. And a lot of the work I did there involved working with people who were marginalized, minoritized, or had mental health difficulties or disabilities. That led me into working for the whole of the University of Oxford rather than one department. And then I ended up working at the University of York, leading on a variety of things, including inclusion. In 2016, I ended up going freelance and working for a variety of reasons. Partly my wife is about to do a master's program, so I became a house husband and consultant.
A house husband. I'm going to give you a little bit of a clap there.
Thank you. I, with all the privilege that gives me, I know it's, I'm not going to take credit for just, you know, being a parent at home. And that gave me the network that I had working at Oxford and other places, gave me the ability to work in a range of sectors. So mainly higher education, but I work in the arts and culture, heritage, corporate, and third sector as well. So I'm fortunate enough to work across the piece. I found that if you can work collaboratively across all the departments and organizations that form a university, you can all do that at a business level or a community level.
That's amazing. So you work in a couple of different buckets, if you will, different sort of veins. Where did you start with all of those veins, or did it gradually evolve as you saw the need?
In the inclusion space that I work in, I focus a lot on what we'd call disability or neurodiversity, mental health inclusion. But I work across those areas in different organizations. And then also we might touch on gender inequality or racial inequality or areas of socioeconomic deprivation or backgrounds. I know deprivation is not quite the right word, but all that kind of knowledge and experience that comes from working in a university setting is applicable in lots of other organizations. In terms of the work I do in men's mental health, that came out of working in educational settings, but that's much more at a community level. And so there's a great organization in York, my hometown in England, called Mentfulness. And a lot of the insight that you get from working in an educational community applies across a kind of male mental health organization as well.
You're making me feel a little bit like a kid in a candy store because you have so many different areas and angles to take this from that I'm so overwhelmed. I'm not even precisely sure which one I want to go down. But the first one I want to touch on is this neurodiversity concept. What is one of the biggest misconceptions about neurodiversity and accommodations regarding mental health that you see?
Okay, so I think there's still a deficit model around neurodiversity. And I think there's a little bit of a backlash at the moment, certainly in the UK, with this kind of idea of why all of a sudden does a lot of people I know share that they have lived experience of ADHD or autism or those kind of labels or identity. So I think there's a kind of misconception that it's something that you know about when you're younger or when you're in school or in education or in your first job. And for many people who have successfully lived with strategies that enable them to do great work alongside having that lived experience of, say, ADHD or autism. Certainly the lockdown phases of the pandemic and certainly changes in organization, you know, working at, mainly at home or working remotely, has meant that the strategies that they developed to work successfully in organizations until that point of quite radical and rapid change stopped being effective. So that the level of impairment you might describe in the kind of medical model of disability idea or the societal barriers in a social model became much more pronounced and meant that those strategies weren't so effective. So I think looking at neurodiversity as a talent, not in a very kind of pat you on the head, you know, kind of dismissive way. I mean, from the perspective of, okay, we've got some real talents in this group of individuals. How do we enhance them? How do we bring them out? Just as you would anyone else in the organization, what's your strength? Not what's your superpower, but what's your strength and how can we enable us to remove some of the challenges that prevent you working in that really effective way?
What you knew then and what you knew now is probably dramatically different. How has your perspective and your perception evolved and changed over time?
I think actually the optimism that I began with is still there. I still think that, yeah, I think people still have the opportunity to change their perception and to change their practice. I think what's less possible at the moment is that there's less funding and less opportunity to do so in a kind of educational setting. That may change again. You know, I think we go through peaks and troughs, so that may change again, and people may decide to, you know, to be more able to make change. I think once you've seen people go through and achieve and graduate, in spite of your initial response being, I don't think that's going to be possible for whatever reason, I don't think they're going to make it, the system's too hard, or the people working in the system aren't minded to make the changes needed. But when you do see it go through and you hear success at the other end, I think that, you know, that creates a story that you can then use in other ways.
I want to shift gears because you mentioned gender equality, and we've done an episode on gender, but I would love to know, what's your overarching ideology on gender inequality?
Okay, so I would describe myself as an ally and always have been. I think it's very, I certainly remember being uncomfortable, which is what an ally using is, in a role I had where I was leading on inclusion. And we were recognizing that it was the day of the year that women effectively stopped being paid in the office. So what have I tried to do around that actively is to give my power and give my spotlight to others. So I've recently turned down a number of opportunities to be on panels of the kind of thing I've described and said, I'm sure you can find someone who's better equipped to do that than me as your it's not a mantle. I've suggested people, I've put people forward, and I work with a huge range of women who are fantastically talented on lots of fronts, and I make sure that I recognize their contribution in all the projects I do, in all the research that I've undertaken and delivered, and in all the training and opportunities to do. So if I hear a good practice example, I'm working on a project, and I'll shine a light on that deliberately and very kind of specifically to model that, because that it still didn't happen with me.
You have mastered the art of allyship, but I think a lot of people are scared to try because they don't know how to do it correctly. It's sort of that analysis paralysis that stops. What advice do you have around men being a strong advocate for women and an ally for women if they're just getting so nervous?
So face the fear and do it anyway. And that allyship brings discomfort and expect that. I think you've probably got a number of women around you who you can sense check things with. So you're not alone in being an ally. And get ready for a bit of pushback. But you don't need to be. I think the other thing that I've been talking about recently with a lot of organizations is this concept of productive disagreement. And the reason I'm bringing that in is because part of this productive disagreement is not coming out on top or winning in an argument or a discussion. It's about getting the point across. It's about being clear. If you don't feel that you need to win, And Daniel Kahneman sadly died recently. He's a great researcher and person who identified, along with his collaborator Amos Tversky, the idea of System 1 and System 2 thinking. System 1 is that instinctive response, and the System 2 is more of a considered response. And I think tapping into that System 2 response in a discussion, slowing things down, being clear on what the aims and outcomes are, and, you know, take a breath and then speak, is really good advice. It's not about winning. It's not about coming out on top. And it's not about dominating. And sometimes you just need to allow the other person to feel that they've won. And that's fine.
I see that from both genders right now, is that they're at war versus connection or collaboration, because both party, and I see this a lot on social media, wants to be right. What's your opinion on that?
If you are a divisive, angry voice, you win on social media. But in the real world, where a lot of discourse and discussion happens, that's not the case. And a lot of social media driven truth, when you bring that out into the light, it dies, because, you know, it's not backed by numbers, it's not backed by facts, it's not backed by a large group of people who support that. It's amplified on social media. And then some of the work that myself and people I work with do is to take the heat out of it and actually discuss it in a workplace, in a study, or in a community setting.
So much of what you said is also applicable to racial inequality.
I mean, in the UK, it's still racial inequality is impactful. I don't know if it has the same cross-societal impact as it does in the US, from my understanding. But within the minority communities that I work with and for, there is a sense of, again, there's peaks and troughs of it, and I think we're in a kind of societal backlash against that. I think the Black Lives Matter and sort of themes that emerged from the sad death of George Floyd and many others have ramifications in the UK. But it harked back to our histories of the 70s and 80s, and where my childhood was in a maelstrom of division on racial grounds as well as on economic grounds. But there was I think there's part of the decolonization or the diversification of our histories is showing the powerful impact that Black and brown communities in the UK sense had on fighting against injustice, whether that be economic, racial, etc. The miners' strike in the 80s in the UK, that is a really good example.
And they do contribute so many diverse perspectives.
And now a lot of the work we have in the UK is around making sure that there's people from diverse backgrounds, particularly those racially diverse communities from our colonial legacy, but also from our immigration and other communities, are given the opportunities they deserve within our education and employment settings.
I've spoken before to someone that feels that university is essentially the best way to deprogram yourself, because you're in a community and in a space with so many different people, people that you may never cross paths with. What is your best advice for someone to really start to become an ally, start to become socially, emotionally, mentally conscious and aware?
I'd agree to some extent about university being that opportunity, certainly to discuss ideas. But I also think it's important to keep firmly rooted in a community as well. So a lot of people move away to study, and some people stay at home. But I think there's still the position that you can get to where there's a kind of group thing, and you find your people who you agree with. I still think there's that need to do more broader work, whether that's socially or whether it's part of your kind of trajectory into the workplace or is what you love doing. I think you've still got to work hard to make sure that the people around you are not always like you. So whether that's through volunteer work, if you're in the privileged position to be able to do that, or in employment or sport or other activities, I think that's really important to find a diverse range of backgrounds. There's a wonderful organization in the UK, came from its roots in tragedy, from the death of a member of parliament called Joe Cox, who was effectively assassinated by a right-wing extremist in my hometown. An organization that grew up out of her death is called More in Common. And in June, which is the birthday and the sad anniversary of your death, we have the Great Get-Together, which is over a weekend and promotes that we have more in common than that which divides us, which was a line from one of her maiden speeches in the House of Parliament. So that idea that we have lots of commonality with people who may be different from us. And I think there's a lot of power in that recognition, a lot of power in that knowledge, and a lot of power in that practice. So I still need to actively engage in communities which are nothing like me, to learn, to develop, and also, you know, learn who I am and what my, you know, kind of core principles and beliefs are.
Because you evolve and you grow. Oh, that's beautiful. That's very beautiful. Now I have a hard question for you. If you could share three actionable pieces of advice and or strategies regarding any of the work that you do, really three things that you want to share, what would those three things be?
Okay. I'm just thinking about what we've been doing recently in the work that I've been doing with organization. So one thing is take a breath. Learn to take a breath and pause. Yeah, it's really important. Box breathing, it's called in some instances, but practice that. I think writing down at the end of the day what you've done well at and what you are, you know, what success has been that day, I think it's really important, particularly in challenging times, you know, kind of journaling about what's gone well and creating that as an opportunity for the next day. Kind of linked to those two things in a way is really good for me personally. I've heard of people show up and listen. You know, kind of, I'm good at filling in those quiet time in interaction when it's sometimes good to sit and listen and let other voices come in, whether they be people from an introverted perspective or people from a neurodiverse perspective. You need a bit more time to think. I think it's really important to. So take a breath, slow things down, reflect and listen. And then those are the kind of things that are more important at the end of each day.
Because when you're quiet, you can also hear your opportunities for growth. And if you're always going at 100 miles an hour, you're not going to understand maybe where you don't have the knowledge or haven't been empathetic or haven't really opened that listening ear.
Yeah. And with that allyship perspective that you asked me for earlier, I think it's progress, not perfection. So don't worry about being perfect in an ally. Just keep making progress, because those missteps and those clunky experiences you have are part of that full breath out of my life of someone who's actively involved in that allyship process.
That reminds me of when I sit down to write like a congratulations card or somebody graduates and you always sort of second guess or you question what you've written, but writing something kind and compassionate is so much better than writing nothing. And I think we do that to ourselves. Oh, well, I might not say the right thing. It's not always about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Just write what you know, take a breath and write.
If you were going to share a one sentence to two sentence piece of advice that people would just cut their mantra, if you will, from this episode, what would that be? Kind of their short little one.
I don't know why it's coming to my head. It is better to light a candle than to toss the dart. It's something that has always come along. And the reason I'm saying that, at the moment, there's a backlash against some of the work that I'm involved in, whether that EDI is being defunded, I know in the States, but kind of is being questioned in the UK. Is ADHD real? You know, is it not being made up? Is everyone diagnosing everyone else with ADHD at the moment? So it is better to light a candle than to kiss the dark, and just focus on this progress. Not perfection. We need to keep moving forward. But with an evidence base, we need to be clear on what we're doing and not just for the sake of what we're doing, but why we're doing this, what's the evidence that this is going to be successful, and how do we make sure that happens in practice in terms of good equity.
I love that quote. I've never heard it before. You can learn so much about who somebody is by what they share in that one to two sentence blurb. So I learned a lot about you. Pete, I've had so much fun with you. Firstly, I love the different directions this took. It's very different than I expected. If somebody is enamored with what you've said and they want to connect with you, how can they do so?
They can find me on LinkedIn, Pete Quinn Consulting. I'm on that. I'm on Twitter.
He's brave. He's on Twitter.
Well, I think it's important to hear what the other side is saying, if that's a thing. I think those are the two places you're probably most likely to find me.
I am really grateful to come out to speak with me today. It certainly did not disappoint. Pete, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining me on Campus Chronicles. I hope you found our discussion informative, inspiring, entertaining, and fun. We are always working hard to make sure that our episodes are the very best they can be, which means we need your help. If you liked what you heard, remember to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast platform and drop us a review. It helps us to connect with more students who are hungry for success. And remember, the journey never stops. Keep listening, keep learning, keep growing. See you next week for another amazing episode of Campus Chronicles.